Welcome to The Plants We Eat, an investigation of the history, biology, and culture of the plants that we use for food. My name is Jeff Gilman. I'm the director of the UNC Charlotte Botanical Gardens and a plant history buff.
And I'm Cindy Proctor, instructor from Central Piedmont Community College in Charlotte in the horticulture department, and I enjoy being everyone's garden coach.
There you go. Now, today we're going to be discussing a crop which is, I think that this is all about a story of excess. And the crop today is sugarcane. Sugarcane really produces, when you start to think about it, sugarcane produces an incredible number of foods for us. Have you ever stopped and thought about all the things that sugarcane produces?
I mean, when you do think about it, it produces not only sugar,
right. But
a lot of derivatives of sugar that probably people wouldn't like to say is good for you.
Right, exactly.
Sweeteners.
We're talking about, just at the raw end, you've got your sugar, your brown sugar, your molasses, all kinds of things that panea, which is basically just a solid chunk of sucrose. Just all these things that eventually make sweets.
Did you know that brown sugar is just sugar with molasses in it?
Actually, yes, I did. I'm sure we're both researching all the same thing. It's a fascinating, crop though. And in terms of sugar, so there are all kinds of places that sugar actually can come from. But in terms of the sugar that we find on our plates, in our tea, in our coffee, there's two primary plants that sugar does come from in terms of production. And that's sugarcane or sugar beets. And sugarcane is by far makes up the lion's share. Mm-hmm. It produces about 80% of the sugar that we find on our plates.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, if you're if you're into the whole organic thing, you're almost certainly eating sugarcane because most of the sugar beets that we use are genetically modified. But we'll be talking about sugar beets at some point in the future. We haven't scheduled sugar beets yet, but yeah, it's on our list.
Okay.
On our long, long list. So sugarcane is this tall tropical grass that can reach 15 feet or more in height. We say it's a tropical grass. Have you ever taken like a grass stem, just any grass, and just chewed it between your teeth?
Sure.
And it's a little bit sweet, right?
Right.
Well, the thing is, many of your grasses are what we call photosynthetically efficient. And by photosynthetically efficient, what I mean is that they're able to take light and use it efficiently to make other things. What are other things? Well, everything from the structure of a stem to fruits to seeds, and even the stuff inside a stem. And the stuff inside a stem, in the case of sugarcane, is actually sugar. And then we're able to process this sugar and use it. I actually want to quote Devens Gust, who's a professor in charge of the history for bioenergy and photosynthesis at Arizona State University. And he says, based on the amount of carbon fixed by a field of corn during a typical growing season, only about 1 to 2% of the solar energy falling on the field is recovered as new photosynthetic products. And again, these photosynthetic products are things like fruits or stems or leaves, whatever. The efficiency of uncultivated plant life is only about 0.2%. In sugarcane, which is one of the most efficient plants, about 8% of the light absorbed by the plant is preserved as chemical energy. And of course, this chemical energy is sugar. Now, this, for people, it's kind of crazy. Efficient people who are efficient with food, end up being a little bit heavier. And we think of that as a bad thing. Plants, which are efficient, have to preserve this energy in some way. And the way that they preserve it is as sugar. And specifically, it's as sucrose. Because sugarcane is so efficient at storing this solar energy, what that means is that the stem is absolutely packed. It's so photosynthetically efficient. It saves so much carbon dioxide, which it can only do because it uses the light so efficiently, that it stores in its stems this incredible amount of sugar. And of course, being humans, once we figured this out, we started using it because, hey, We love our sugar, which enables us to, you know, get bigger.
That's right. It tastes so good.
It tastes so good. Exactly. So sugarcane is originally from New Guinea. Then it slowly made its way, and of course New Guinea is next to Australia, in case you were wondering. It slowly made its way across the Pacific and eventually got to India. And in India, that's where it was first refined. So in New Guinea, it was, you chew on the stems, you enjoy the flavor of the stems, kind of the way that we would chew on grass stems out in our backyard. But then when it got to India, it was refined. And by refined means the sugar was actually concentrated. And then it was actually used as a medicine. So the people in Asia actually thought of it as a medicine. And of course, it does work as a medicine. Sugar, we're able to use it right away in our bodies. Our bodies are able to use it rapidly. That's why we crave it. Sugar is pure energy. I mean, think about it. It's actually like sun energy. That's what the plant's doing. It's taking the sun energy, converting it over, and then we're able to use it. We don't have to process anything to get this energy.
Yes, that's true.
So it's eating this pure energy. And so it does work as a medicine to some extent, because it means our bodies have to work less to get this energy. In 1099, during the Crusades, the Europeans, of course, found out about this sugar, and they loved it, so they brought it to Europe. There was a huge demand when they discovered this sugar cane, but there wasn't enough availability, and it really didn't become common in Europe until about 1300. There weren't actually a lot of places in Europe that could really grow it very well. Sugar cane likes a lot of sunlight, and it likes a lot of moisture. Now, sugar really starts becoming important in the 1500s. Okay, in 1493, Columbus actually brought sugar to Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and then in 1500, or actually just after 1500, sugar reached Brazil, and Brazil pretty rapidly became the largest producer. It simply had the right climate, the right conditions for sugar to take over. Then coffee, tea, and chocolate reached Europe in the 1500s and 1600s. Now, these are naturally bitter foods, and they are really, really improved by additions of sugar. And if there was a demand for sugar before, well, with coffee, tea, and chocolate, this really just pushed it over the edge, the demand for sugar was extreme. And because of this demand, one of the real problems with sugar over the years, one of the sad parts of sugar's history took over. The slave trade took over the production of sugar in the 1500s and 1600s. In terms of sugar consumption, in 1700, it was about 4 pounds per person per year. By 1900, it was 60 pounds per person per year. Now listen to this. Listen to this one, and then think about this: what this means per day. Today, we eat an average of 150 pounds of sugar per year.
Now, I had 100. Are you sure it's 150?
I found a number of different sources.
Okay.
The one that it depends on the person, it depends on the situation. I'll say that I picked one of the higher ones, but it was one of the higher ones that had some reasonable evidence. So yeah, I picked the higher one, but there was.
It depends on how much coffee I drink.
Right. But think about 150 pounds of sugar. What does that mean per day? That means per day you're eating you could be eating half a pound of sugar a day at the high end. But think about it. Is that really that odd? Think about how much is just in a can of soda. You know, if you're drinking a can of soda, how much sugar is there? How much sugar is in a few chocolates? How much sugar is in your cereal in the morning? It adds up really, really rapidly.
It really does. I'm thinking about how many 5-pound bags that is. And I mean, you think about all the baking we do and the recipes we make requires just a little bit of sugar here and there.
Right, exactly. Even in a loaf of bread, there's actually a decent amount of sugar there. Of course, all of this sugar doesn't come from sugarcane. So this isn't all sugarcane, but I'd say that much of it does, a majority mm-hmm. of it does. So now I want to go back to, again, part of the sad history of sugar, and that's the slavery, because this is a really fascinating and incredibly sad time in history. Sugar was craved by Europeans and by people in America during the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. And it was craved, again, because it made certain delicious foods more palatable. Again, our coffee, tea, and our chocolate. It did serve as a medicine, and people just loved it because it was quick energy. You know, that's why we crave sugar. We crave this easily digestible, fast energy. So there was an incredible demand for this particular crop. In the 17th century, that's the 1600s, over 500,000 slaves were shipped to the Americas to work on sugar plantations. Most of them were being shipped to Brazil, to the Caribbean. And they were shipped there to do what was absolutely back-breaking labor. They were cutting down sugarcane. They were processing it, and the processing was actually quite dangerous. You can look at film of how the processing is done today, and you can see that it looks at least reasonably safe, but back then they were using machinery that could literally tear people's arms off, and they would have standing by, sugarcane actually has to be sucked through wheels that are crushing it, and these crushers could literally suck in a person's arm, suck in their whole body. They would have a person with a machete standing beside these machines to cut people's arms off if they got caught, so that the person could continue to live, basically. If the person was maimed, that person would actually continue to work on the sugar plantation. Slave labor on sugar plantations was considered some of the hardest and worst labor that a slave could do. In total, slavery dominated sugar production for over 300 years and used 10 million Africans. That's how many people essentially died on sugar plantations. Now, to understand how important sugar was to the European economy, you have to understand that overseas commodities accounted for a third of Europe's economy, and sugar was by far the most important of these. And countries that controlled sugar production protected it. They had to. Sugar was part of this, was known as a triangular trade route, where ships would sail from England with goods. They'd deliver these goods to Africa. Then there they would collect slaves. They'd then drop these slaves off in South America and pick up sugar and rum, rum of course being the alcohol associated with sugarcane, and then return to England. So there was this triangular trade route from England to Africa to South America. So sugar was extremely important. Again, the most important of these commodities these overseas commodities that dominated European economy. The interesting thing to me, though, about this is that in South America, and this is not true of anywhere else, but in South America, the African slaves outnumbered the plantation owners by a tremendous number. And this is the only place, I mean, all the colonies where there were slaves, South America was the only place where there was this overwhelming number difference between, again, the slaves and the plantation owners. And what that meant was that the plantation owners were constantly fearful that the slaves would revolt. So you actually had a large number of military outposts whose primary goal was to keep slaves from revolting. Certainly, they were also there to protect this valuable commodity, but mostly they were there to prevent slave revolt. Now, the interesting thing to me is that there are a number of history professors who believe that the number of soldiers that they had to keep in South America to control the slaves was extremely important to the success of the American Revolution, because Britain had to maintain so many soldiers in South America, it could not divert these soldiers north to help Britain control the United States.
So I read that too.
So it's very interesting.
That's a positive thing.
Right. That's obviously a positive thing. We would probably not be a country today if it weren't for the fact that Britain had to control the South American slaves. Interesting, again, kind of sad. After slavery in the 1860s, we certainly had more mechanization, but even today, sugar production requires a great deal of labor. Right after slavery, it was indentured servants. In other words, indentured servants, not exactly slavery, is basically have people who agree to work for a certain period of time in return for
land
or or something like that. Today, it's a number of local people do the work. Still a huge industry, but today it's largely mechanized. Fascinating crop with a lot of sad notes.
Well, it's mostly developed in Brazil now.
Yes.
Grown in Brazil.
Yeah.
And if you've ever seen videos of how it's processed or harvested, I can, and it's all mechanized, like you said, but I can't imagine doing that by hand. It would be with a machete.
Yeah.
And I read that they would set fire to the fields to get rid of vermin and dry leaves before they went in there. To use the machete to remove the canes.
Well, one of the fascinating things about sugar production is that it's so photosynthetically efficient, once again, that even after you remove the sugar, you're left with this waste product. That waste product can actually be used to run all the sugar mills with power left over. And Brazil largely runs on ethanol and this and these wastes left over. It's just incredible how much power and calories all at the same time sugar can provide. I mean, it's this crazy efficient crop that where you can grow it is just.
So I don't know about other countries, but it's my understanding that Coke and Pepsi do not use sugar in the United States in their products.
That's correct.
And so corn syrup.
Yes.
And that made sense. Like if you're in other countries and you had a Coke, you're like, this tastes different. It's just a little underlying difference in its taste. It's because they're still using sugar in the Coke sold overseas. I don't know if that's the case for every country. Anyway, I thought that was interesting.
It is interesting. Well, sugar is even cheaper down there than it is up here, but I think that we're mostly using this high fructose corn syrup for political reasons to, you know.
Oh, of course.
Right. But really, sugar would be cheaper.
Sugar would be cheaper and be better for you. Possibly.
Possibly.
You have to weigh it's, that.
That's highly questionable, actually. You know, one thing that I didn't mention is that sugarcane, we think of sugarcane as a single species. Actually, it's a number of different species that are grown and hybridized into special cultivars, which are, you know, just more and more efficient and more fast growing.
You won't see those at garden centers, though.
No. Well, do you find sugarcane at garden centers?
No. The places I've seen it is the cane itself, which is very bamboo looking, and you could build a house with sugar cane. It is so strong. You would find it at farmers markets where somebody has grown it locally, and it's not very attractive. I don't recommend growing it, really, unless you're in Central Florida, because it needs like 10 months to thrive. It's a zone 9-10 plant, and it needs a lot of heat and a lot of humidity and a lot of rainfall. And so usually the more tropical areas of our country can satisfy those requirements.
Now, Hawaii, I would assume that you could grow it in Hawaii.
I don't think they have enough land to devote
It is land intensive. Yeah. And I didn't realize that it took 10 months to get through a harvest cycle.
And it could be even longer depending on if you decide to grow it further north in the country, mm-hmm. then you have to have a greenhouse situation, and the cold is going to delay, you know, mm-hmm. its growth. So, right. but so yeah, it's something that you could try. You could take that section from, or take that piece from the farmer's market. And it's, if you look at it, it has nodes, those mm-hmm. circling areas around the whole bamboo looking piece. You can usually buy them, I would say, about 2 to 3 feet long. Mm-hmm. And you have to cut those up, keeping a node intact. And you can grow it that way. But again, heat is the key.
So it's not a hard plant to grow?
It's not, only if you have to put it in a pot, like if you're in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. If you're in Central Florida, you could put it directly in the ground because it's just warm, mm-hmm. you know, for a much longer period of time. You don't have freezing, you know, as an issue to delay its growth or even kill it. So you could try it that way, but it does grow. Like in plantations in Brazil, it's going to reach 15 feet tall. Here, it's probably going to be 8 to 10 feet, you know, even right. and. Again, try it in zone 5. If that's where you live, you just need a greenhouse situation,
well,
obviously.
Well, the thing is, it's going to be building up these sugars regardless. So even even non-mature sugar cane, you know, for a few months, you should have that additional sugar within that internode area.
Well, that center part of the plant is really what gives the highest concentration. And okay. you need to harvest it before it blooms. You know, mm-hmm. and that
right.
makes sense. You
right,
know,
because a bloom takes a lot of energy.
It does. And it looks like this elongated, gigantor blade of grass that has mm-hmm. incredible girth with the strength of bamboo. I don't know how else to describe it.
Well, it can actually be crossed with bamboo. You can actually get sugarcane bamboo hybrids.
Okay, now what would we do with that?
Well, you know, it was an interesting thing. I found this article on growing these sugarcane bamboo hybrids, uh-huh. but then they really didn't have, you know, exactly why you do it, but you can do it.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, just because. That's
well,
okay.
Well, you know, hey, academics are
That's
called
right.
academics
it's
for
okay.
a reason.
I love academics.
That's right.
But the thing is growing it and starting it in a pot, you have mm-hmm. to get it to root, and you're not going to get it to root without at least 70 degree soil temperatures. That's really warm. You
Which
know.
Actually makes sense to me, though.
Sure. That it thrives in tropical areas, of course
right.
it does.
Yeah.
And you have to have at least 20 inches or more of rain. I would think you would need more, given that we mm-hmm. here are 45 inches a year,
yeah.
you know, and further south can be even more, especially in Florida and Louisiana areas.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you do try it, it would be kind of a novelty thing to do. It's not very attractive to look at. It's just,
it's
it looks
not.
Like a huge weed.
Well,
know?
it looks like, it's, think of an ugly bamboo.
That's right. I mean,
that's really what it looks like. It's
but
an ugly bamboo.
Have you seen pictures of plantations? They're gorgeous. They're beautiful. Mm-hmm. But they have acres and acres, you know, mm-hmm. of a plant when you have just a few, you know, wiry looking, you know.
Right, right.
grass looking things. It's not very attractive. Now to harvest it, you know, you might lose a finger.
Well, if you're only growing 3 or 4 plants, it wouldn't be that tough.
No, but you would, you know,
it
cutting
would still
it
take
off
a machete.
So yeah, machete. And that's how they did it before it was in the plantations, before it was mechanized. But yeah, you cutting it off at the base wouldn't be a big deal, but scraping the sides mm-hmm. of the stem, or the blade, I should say, is really hard and intensive. And then that centerpiece is what tastes so good. But why not, you know, we're so concerned about sugar consumption. I think we should grow stevia.
That's a great idea. Stevia is easy to grow.
You could adorn containers with mm-hmm. it, and it wouldn't even look
it's
like
it's a pretty attractive plant, too.
It is
too.
Pretty attractive. It's kind of leafy, you yeah. know, and yeah. you can dry the leaves and mm-hmm. Put it in your coffee grinder,
yep.
store it in the refrigerator, and you have your own stevia.
I think that's a much better idea.
Yeah, and it's pretty widely available. Yeah. In most areas.
Yeah, it's pretty common. People don't realize it. It's not, certainly not a petunia, but it's an attractive plant.
Now, I want to thank you for suggesting to do sugarcane, because a lot of the things that we do haven't made such an impact. You know, they're kind of an addition to our food palette and kind of mm-hmm. and make life great, but sugarcane has really is instrumental in a lot of change in the world.
It is.
Good, some, bad, and indifferent.
Good, bad, and indifferent.
Yes.
And
so I enjoyed this. Thank you.
It was definitely a different plant to look at. Thank you for listening. This is a production of the UNC Charlotte Botanical Gardens and UNC Charlotte College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. I'd like to also thank Alex Frizzell with the UNC Charlotte Isle Group, Alex Chapin with the CLAS IT Group, and we look forward to talking with you next week.